Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So this would be the Media Project, a half hour of commentary, analysis, and perhaps even some insight into what's going on in the news media around this country. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with my two colleagues, Rosemary Armeo, director of the journalism program at the University of Albany.
Hello.
Hello, investigative journalist, former editor, and so on. Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, and, you know, all kinds of other things.
Hey, Rexy, that's the nicest thing you've ever said about me.
Nicest thing I've ever said. Hey, says here that PolitiFact, the not-for-profit news site, raised $105,000 in 20 days. How about that?
That's excellent, isn't it?
That's just a little setup. Alan, let's see. How much money did you raise in one day at WAMC?
Well, while I am still not in possession of the final thing, we had a lockbox. We had everybody put in as much as they could. We raised $500,000 doing that. And on the first day, we raised another $500,000.
That's amazing.
And in the meantime, we raised $133,000, which had nothing to do with the fund drive, but was because the money was coming in. We said, this is a good time to prepare for the fact that Breitbart and the others have said, let's privatize public radio.
Yeah.
So we said, let's get it in just in case they take the money away. We'll have a third of it in each of our three fund drives. And the money came pouring in. And one of your reporters on the Times Union asked me, to what do you ascribe this? And I said, it's all Trump. And it is all Trump.
What do you know? Well, it's a great thing.
One day, by the way. It was a one-day fund.
It was quite amazing. We have talked before in this program about the shifting media landscape, the industry being imperiled by the decline of retail advertising, and the possibility that more news organizations will turn to not-for-profit status the way public radio has been for a half century now.
You know, Rex, there is always an unforeseen kind of consequence that comes with any kind of new innovation. So let's just say it's a great thing that the Berkshire Eagle, for example, was bought by some heavy hitters who wanted a good newspaper in Berkshire County. And let's move away from the Berkshire Eagle now, because maybe that is where I am a columnist, I have to say, and bring it to another place. Let's just say any other newspaper that is a not-for-profit. Sooner or later, you have this oligarchy that develops, and you have one guy at the head of the oligarchy. If it's a not-for-profit oligarchy or if it's a profit oligarchy, they can still be a stinker.
Present company excluded, of course.
Well, that's right. And that's why I took it away from the That's why I took it away from the Berkshire Eagle, you know, which was just my example.
I see.
But you see, that is exactly what you worry about. Nature abhors a vacuum. We know that there are oligarchies that develop everywhere, whether it's in a for-profit, not-for-profit. You have a great boss who happens to be a Hearst at your newspaper and who is a very decent fellow.
Very lucky.
Well, you know what? There have been college presidents who aren't decent and, you know, in not-for-profits. Yeah. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
I just say that as a warning.
But the model of people donating to support the journalism that matters could be one that's going to have more consequence going forward for PolitiFact, which basically raises its money by the funding from the news organizations themselves. For example, if we said Times Union would be the home of PolitiFact New York, we would pay the organization a certain amount of money, and then we would assign certain members of our staff to act in ways in concert with the PolitiFact brand.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, in the old days, competition was a no-no. And you had public radio and you had newspaper and you had... Now everybody is saying, hey, maybe there's some ways we can combine things and we can make it better and save some money while we're doing it.
I like the old days when journalists got to spend their time in journalism, but I think they're gone. I've worked for 10 years for an organization that does anti-corruption reporting internationally.
Yeah.
And it gets money from a number of different government agencies, including the State Department and USAID. But they also go to the Brits, the Swedes, the Scandinavians are very generous for investigative reporting. And now individual donors are coming forward, rich people who just want to do something. You see this in crowdsourcing, too. That's kind of a spin-off where
it's all Trump, I tell you.
It's all Trump.
You think about it. And the media needs to cover this well. You know, there are so many organizations and not-for-profits and others who are benefiting from the fact that people are scared to hell of Donald Trump and the kinds of things he does and says. I mean, who would have ever thunk we'd have a one-day fund drive, one-day on-air fund drive at WAMC?
Well, there is the bad side, of course, is you don't have time to do journalism if you're raising money. The good side is you have a lot more independence, which makes for great journalism. The group I was just talking about takes money from the State Department and yet looks at money laundering and bribery and those kinds of things overseas. So there's a high chance that it could run into something like, say, Donald Trump's companies or friends of Donald Trump. What happens to the government money when that happens? Do
exactly.
we print it? Are we free to print it?
Shartok's law.
What's
Betty?
That?
You take money from the government, some politician will think that that is their personal money and that they can leverage you with their personal money. We'll take it away. We've seen it in newspapers, for example. We've talked about it many times with the legal advertising.
Yes, well, that is imperiled. Legal advertising could always go away, and there's been a proposal on the part of Governor Cuomo to do that in New York State. But it's tied into a change in the way the state would actually fund projects, public works projects. And so it may well be that because he's tied it into a lack of accessibility of the information, it may well be that that'll go away. I do just want to go back to something you said, though. You know, there is always a possibility that funding sources, whether they're private or public, could try to exercise influence over content. You know, newspapers have existed with great independence from their advertisers' influence for years only because publishers have insisted upon it. That is, if you have a publisher who says, well, you really have to write a nice story about this furniture store that's opening up
sure.
because the furniture store is buying ads, you're in trouble as an editor if you give in to that. And what we've always been able to say is these advertisers buy access to our readers. They don't buy access to our news columns. But, you know, that gets more difficult, let's just say, if you don't have any money. If you have less revenue, you become more imperiled in your independence.
So let me ask both of you a question. Is there some kind of inverse rule in which we know that as the newspaper gets bigger, they're more immune from that? So, for example, is the Albany Times Union or the Kingston Freeman more likely to have a problem with that advertising conundrum you just posited than the New York Times?
Could have, but I think it depends. There also has been the sense that there are certain readers that you can only reach if you're an advertiser, if you go into these publications. If you're trying to reach somebody who lives in Kingston, maybe you really need the Kingston Daily Freeman to get to them, and so that gives that newspaper some independence from advertiser pressure because the advertisers have to be there or else they can't sell in Kingston. So I think there's something to be said for size, power, giving you more independence. But
to be done for transparency, too. Numerous cases where advertisers have put the pressure on, stories about that pressure have made them look so bad that it didn't do them any good.
Yeah.
You might as well just pay the money, take the lumps. And if you are a good advertiser, I can remember a paper in Virginia that was looking at a story that involved a major advertiser, someone who would not have been hesitant to pull ads or worse, to sue. And we pursued the story, but we were well aware that you have to nail this down. There can be no problems. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, those higher standards should apply all the time. So I don't think it's a bad thing, and I don't think advertisers really have a lot of clout when they try to pull.
We had that a couple of years ago. We had a story that involved a major advertiser, and I held it because I wanted to be sure that we had it right, because I knew that this imperiled a significant advertising contract. We got the story cold. We made so many efforts to reach out to this advertiser. Give us your comments. Tell us what you think. We got no response. We published the story. The advertiser pulled the advertising. It's a major loss to our bottom line at the Times Union. But I have a publisher who is not going to be intimidated by that. And I wish we had that revenue coming in, you know. It's a couple of reporter salaries, and it's a drag to not have it. But you can't let that kind of pressure influence your journalism.
And pressure comes in many ways. I remember, let's just say, I'll make this up, a supermarket owner who heard a story, which wasn't a bad story, but they didn't like, or he didn't like, and his secretary called me up and said, he demands to have an audio copy of that right away. So I sent it to him. But in fact, I know what was intended.
Right.
What was intended was pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of like being the first lady and bringing a lawsuit against a tiny little paper and
a tiny little blog, because her chance to make a bundle of money is imperiled.
I felt so bad for her.
Oh, yeah. Her once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to make a lot of money because she's the first lady. And
she'll be one of the most photographed women in the world because of her status.
And married to a billionaire while we're at it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's separate. There's also, she settled a lawsuit against this little Maryland blogger, a guy named Webster Tarpley. He's issued an apology. He's agreed to pay her a substantial sum because he wrote that she had suffered a breakdown after she plagiarized portions of the convention speech from Michelle Obama. So,
oh, that's the new one.
That's one that she settled. There's this other one that involves her. It's the Daily Mail, right?
Daily Mail used the story. The little blogger wrote that she was part of an escort service. She wasn't really a model. She was a prostitute, in essence. And there's no basis for that. It's definitely fake news.
Yeah. So, you know, it is appropriate for that. Well, I should say, is it appropriate then? If it was not true, if it was fake news, what is the appropriate recourse then for the First Lady?
Well, there are those of us who think that Donald Trump is a big bully. And this just is an extension of bullyism. In other words, the people who have the most money can afford to have, hey, if I was a multi-billionaire and I'm a bit of a hypochondriac, I would have a doctor there with me all day long. You know, take my pulse several times a day and say, and the same thing goes with lawyers. I mean, lawyers, some of these guys make $1,000 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the hours go by fast because they think about your case while they're driving along somewhere.
So, billed for 40 hours a day.
So obviously, if you have access to a good, aggressive lawyer, mucho facto lawyer, that's the initials that are used quite frequently to describe that brand of...
mucho facto.
MF.
Yeah.
Well, that's one aspect of the story that's scary, is that the lawyer in this case is Charles Harder, the main lawyer in the Gawker case.
Sure.
Remember, involving Hulk Hogan and the use of his sex tape. Lovely story on Gawker Media. And they basically were bankrupted by the decision.
Yeah, it brought down Gawker. So there is that peril.
If I had my way, Rex, I would have a lawyer sitting right outside my office ready to go. Sue this one. Sue that one.
Well, if you're the president, though, let's go to this other topic. Since we got onto one of the Trumps, let's go to the other one. What about this notion with the press being the opposition party, as Steve Bannon says? Sanford Unger, who was a PBS correspondent, then became the president of Goucher College in Maryland, and now lectures on journalism at Princeton and Georgetown. Sanford Unger has a piece in the Washington Post that says journalists should embrace that, should say, okay, we are the opposition because we stand in support of facts and honesty as opposed to dishonesty. The difficulty with that stance, however, is that the president has an awful lot of support, and the press doesn't have a lot of friends these days, right?
Well, yeah, and one of the things that's so interesting is how there's a certain kind of mobilization among people, and it follows the press accounts, obviously, of I'll never buy another thing from that store which sells Trump products, or vice versa. They were mean to Trump. They took Ivanka's stuff out of the store, and therefore I'll never buy in that store again either. This has got to be negotiated very carefully by these places, and the media has a great deal to do with it because the media reports on it.
I don't think that the media is the opposition party. That implies that you wish to be in power instead. That's not at all the mission of newspapers. They are there as another branch of the establishment, certainly not of government, but of the establishment. And our job is to look at power, whoever is in power, Republican or Democrat. So I am upset by the idea that we did not hold Obama to account. I mean, on this show alone, in this tiny little Albany, we held Obama to account on many, many occasions. So that's just baloney. I do think there's a lot of coverage. James Warren had a piece. He's a media critic. And he spent some time talking to really right-wingers. news journalists, but who are on the conservative side, and asked them what they thought about the press. I found it very illuminating along the lines of, you have to listen to your critics and see if there's anything of value in it. And he said, you know, you really, they have to win back credibility, which I think we do. And the way you do that is to just figure out the long-term story that you're going to cover, not running around like chickens with their heads cut off, which we truly have been doing for the last 3 weeks, but to figure out what's really going on and to methodically search and report and search and report and keep your eye on the long run. So I think we're only beginning to see it. I love the New York Times response this week when Trump tried to say that the press doesn't cover violent terrorism. And he listed 78 examples of that. And the Times calmly corrected his spelling and then provided links to coverage of each one of those 78 events.
The stories that they did.
Yeah. It didn't say he was a liar. It just said, president says, you know, we haven't covered these things. We found otherwise. That's just methodically go along. I think we have to tuck our chin down and stop responding and just do our jobs.
Yes, but I don't know that resonates with a public that isn't willing to believe when we report factual material. That is more likely to believe. It's much easier to just buy the rhetoric of somebody whom you politically support. And so that when the president says that, as you pointed out, that the media has played down the terror threat, that the terror threat is a lot greater than Americans know because the media has been ignoring it, people are going to believe that. And when the president makes false statements, as he did before the sheriff's group, about the murder rate in our country is the highest it's been in 47 years, absolutely untrue. Absolutely
inversely untrue.
Yeah. Exactly.
And he inflated it by 10 times.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. He did that with labor numbers, too, the number of unemployed people.
But what do you do about that? If you're playing the long game, as James Warren suggests, how do you deal with the consequences of falsehoods being spouted almost daily by the president of the United States? It's very hard to figure out how to handle that.
Well, there's a big debate. Rosemary has been in the forefront of that debate. We've talked about it many times on this program and in other places. And, you know, you call a liar a liar. And there are a lot of newspapers who are now saying he's lying.
Yeah, I keep changing on this because I don't see results by calling him a liar. I thought it was very brave of newspapers to, in the election, not endorse him. And not only not endorse him, but to denounce him in pre-election editorials. And instead, it has earned us a reputation even more so as biased. Now people who long felt that we took one view or the other say, look at the coverage here, and they have a point. And I think I just want to get out of it and leave the critiquing to comedians. I think Melissa McCarthy was more effective in pointing out lies and horrible treatment of the press by the administration in 7 minutes than we have been in 2 years of covering Donald Trump.
Pretty amazing, actually. When make-believe is more real than honest reporting, but it does seem that it works that way. So let's talk about something that seems to be going on in coverage at the Trump White House, and that is increasingly we're seeing citations, sourcing cited as unnamed sources, that is senior U.S. officials who ask not to be identified, or an official who spoke on condition of anonymity, and so on. What do we think about this notion of unnamed sources increasingly being cited as factual, as authoritative in the Trump White House?
Well, Rexy, this has always gone on. I mean, it went on in the last administration. It's going on now. I think one of the new innovations, and I'd love to hear you guys comment on it. I know you do it in your paper, Rex, is to say, didn't want to be identified because didn't have permission. In other words, there's an explanation of why. I don't know that that does anything for you.
I know. It's difficult. Actually, a critic at the Poynter Institute in California said the White House officials, nameless White House officials, have served up more scoops than a Baskin-Robbins.
I like it. Good. Rosemary?
Yeah, that's right. I think it's a big danger. Certainly, it's a temptation. I mean, if you've got people in the inside of the White House saying, these bozos don't even know how to turn the lights on in the place, which was in a New York Times story this week, that would be very hard to resist writing. However, if there's a mistake, if you misinterpret them, if they get something wrong, if you misquote them because of just some accident of reporting and it's an unnamed source, then the White House is going to come back awfully hard saying, see, they're just out to get us. They listen to anything. They're not sourcing. They're not checking.
So let me ask you a question.
That's dangerous.
So let me ask you a question, Rosemary. Are they out to get them?
The media? Are the media out to get the... I don't think so, but are out... Well, no more so than any other president, as Rosemary said. This, even in our little room here, we held Obama to account.
No, Rex, I can't say that. I think there are some presidents that the press... You don't break the rules from fact. If you're a good editor, you hold your reporters back in a case like that. But is there a desire to get Trump in a way that we felt towards Nixon, but did not towards, say, Kennedy?
I see what you're saying. I see. It's well, Kennedy's a little bit too far back in history. It was different norms in journalism in those days. Well, let's take Obama. Is there a different approach? Is there a different feeling about Obama among the press than among Trump?
I wouldn't have picked Obama because he was actually horrible to the press. He looks good now only in comparison to Trump. He sent more leakers to prison for longer terms than anybody else. Yes, he pardoned Chelsea Manning at the end.
So what does that prove? Does that prove, Rosemary, that in fact we give some presidents more of a break than others?
No, I don't think that's true. As I say, I think the editors have to be aware that there's a feeling towards a person, a target of an investigation. And when there is that feeling like, oh, wow, this is a big one, you get more careful, not less careful. That's why in the context of using unnamed sources, I would be so worried about that if my reporters were coming to me with lots of unnamed sources.
But that's practically the only way to cover what's going on in this White House,
absolutely.
Especially when the named sources are founts of misinformation.
Right.
You know, when Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, goes out and lies about crowd size or something.
The bathrobe.
Else.
He lies about a little thing. Right. The same story with the people don't know how to turn on the lights. There was an image of Trump wandering around the White House all alone in a bathrobe. And Sean Spicer's response was, oh, I don't even know where to begin. He doesn't even own a bathrobe. If he does, he certainly doesn't wear it.
So he's walking around naked in the White House.
Well, on the internet, then, there is a flood of pictures of Trump in bathrobes, Trump with Marla in bathrobes. He's been wearing bathrobes all his life. He runs a hotel. He's got thousands of bathrobes.
So the fact is that between the antipathy to the press and the dubious information that comes out of the White House all the time, unnamed sources may be the only way to get authoritative, if anonymous, accounts of what's really going on. And that is the job of the press, is to tell the truth. So
yes.
I think you have to use these unnamed sources.
The problem with the unnamed sources, as I see it, is you never know what the motive of the unnamed source is.
Yeah, well, you do. I mean, if you're good
sometimes
about it.
Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't.
Mostly you do, and mostly it isn't good intentions.
Right.
And the question is the information provable? Is there some way? So I don't know. I just watched All the President's Men again, the movie. It was very inspirational. And they're using unnamed sources in a very similar situation to go after a lying administration. And they make errors. They're going so far out of their way to get people to give them information without committing to it so that they're safe that they make an error in it.
Well, Rex has a colleague, Harry Rosenfeld, who was the boss, right? He was Martin Balsam in the
He was
film,
Martin Balsam, right.
I thought it was Jack Warden.
It was Jack Warden. I think you're right.
Okay.
I just saw it.
Whatever. I stand corrected. I was an unnamed source. But what's interesting is after Deep Throat was named, correct me if I'm wrong, and I know you will, Rex, he said he never knew who Deep Throat was.
But the editor below Harry did.
Oh, is that right?
Harry was assistant managing editor for Metro. The Metro editor who actually was running the team did know, and Harry believes that Ben Bradley, the executive editor, knew as well.
Uh-huh. Because that's one of those protective rules. You have to tell somebody else.
It's an illustrative lesson, though, because Bob Woodward, the reporter, of course, in Watergate, then becomes an editor. And he accepts a story from reporter Janet Cook based on unnamed sources, didn't vet it thoroughly, and the story was a complete hoax. It was as big an embarrassment for the Post as Watergate was a triumph. And if Bob Woodward had not been the editor on the story, I wonder if it would have come through. Reporters in the paper did not believe the Janet Cook story. Listeners may remember that this was a story about an alleged 9-year-old drug addict, and his dealer father was giving him drugs. And the police reporter at the time said, that's nuts. What dealer is going to threaten a lucrative business by injecting his son, his kid?
Which proves to me that you do speak truth to power, even when it's Bob Woodward.
And there you go. Truth to power being the journalism watchword. We'll have to let it go at that because we have run out of time. amazingly enough. We'll come back to it next week. Don't worry. There's more. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Romeo, and Rex Smith, we thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
They are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance.
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, professor emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. And Rosemary Armeo is the director of the journalism program at the University at Albany. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the flow. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policies are...